can you hear me? Rob, in particular, can you hear me? Is there a chance of giving the blinds a twiddle so that they're sort of closed so the light doesn't come through them towards this direction? Other way, if possible, they're sort of... That's it. I was sitting right at the back when Anne Roberts was speaking the other week, and she had lots of pretty pictures, and I was struggling to see them. And I was thinking about my pretty pictures for this week. And I thought, what will I do? I thought, well, let's see if we can fiddle with the blinds. I make no promises about anything that I say, but if at any point you get bored, the pictures are nice. They're worth looking at. More worth looking at than me. Now, I was told about this service, it's supposed to be the first of the summer Sundays, although it's actually, in terms of the series of Psalms, it's really the last, I think, of another series we've been doing. Some of you, I'm aware, have very young children who are physically present in this service. I once had very young children, and I remember those days when they didn't want to be there. But thankfully, most often, I didn't want to be there either. And so, countless occasions when I would gently encourage one of them to start crying, and then, like a mature father, reluctantly carry them out of the room. Feel free to do likewise. I have no issue with that. It would be very hypocritical if I did. We're going to have a look at the first six verses of Psalm 19. I'm firmly committed to finish at 10 to at the latest if Debbie's doing some songs afterwards. Might be earlier than that. Might not be. Cool. In reality, just looking at the very beginning of Psalm 19, but I think that will be enough. We are going to try and look at the whole of the universe in about 20 minutes. The psalm was probably written by King David, in which case it would have been written about 3,000 years ago. Next slide. No, stop there, rather. Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet, their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. As he looked up at the heavens, David was impressed. He was impressed with what he saw. He was impressed by the one who had made it all. We will both begin and end this morning where David finishes. He's impressed by the sun, and in particular by the warmth the sun brings to the earth. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. Next slide. A few pictures of the sun. The sunset, in a sense, is the one that I'm most interested in. The one top left is the most accurate photograph of the sun. Bottom left and top right are not desperately accurate. The thing that interests me about the sunset is certain abilities that we seem to have. And as a Christian, I most certainly believe that we have those abilities because God gave us those abilities. In particular, we have the ability to appreciate creation. We have the ability to appreciate it aesthetically. Just to look at something like a sunset and say, that is extraordinary. That looks really good. We also have the ability to appreciate it scientifically. To appreciate the nuts and bolts behind creation. What's going on in the background. And maybe most significantly, we have the ability to appreciate the Creator, the one who made it all. But first, a quick stroll around the universe. The sun looks unique to us. It's big and yellow and very bright. There is nothing else in the sky that looks quite like it. But it's not unique. It is just a normal star, slightly larger than average. And much closer to us than any other star, which is why it looks so big and bright. Now, it turns out that God made an awful lot of stars. Probably quite a few more than David suspected. Gravity is a very cool force. Everything attracts everything. Because stars are so big, the force pulling them toward each other is very strong. So they tend to hang around in groups. These groups are called galaxies. That's a picture of the Milky Way, which is our local galaxy. It's the one where we live. And if you're looking for yourself, you'll find yourself just sort of down from center, slightly right. You might be able to see the word sun. That's our sun, our star. That's where you are. It's a spiral galaxy. And it contains about 300 billion stars. All a bit like our sun, some bigger, some smaller. That number is on the outer limit of numbers that make any sense to me. It means that if we shared out the stars in our galaxy between every human being on Earth, we'd get about 50 stars each. Surprisingly, even though we're right in the middle of the Milky Way, it is possible to see the Milky Way from the Earth. It is even possible to see the really bright bit in the middle, where there are loads of stars very close together. The Milky Way is the bright line of stars that moves from left to right on that photograph. And we are in it. We are part of it, in the middle of it. It's a bit like sitting in the middle of a frisbee. Most of the time you'd be sort of looking away from the frisbee, but it's possible to look along the edge of the frisbee so that you're just seeing frisbee. It's sort of a bit like that. So there's about 300 billion stars in our galaxy, and I hear you ask the question, well, how many galaxies are there in the universe? The next picture was taken by the Hubble telescope over 10 days, during the Christmas of 1995. I think it had a great time that Christmas. Yes, that's it. Quite hard to give you a feeling for what that is a photograph of, but we'll do our best. I don't know if you can see the little marble in my hands. There is a little marble, trust me. Imagine holding a marble at arm's length and looking at the night sky. The area of sky that that marble would cover up is that size. So what you have there is a bit of sky which is the size of a marble at arm's length. Each of those specks of light is not a star. Each speck of light is a galaxy. Which means each speck of light in that photograph is about 300 billion stars. In total, there are about 3,000 galaxies in the photo, in a tiny, tiny area of space. Let's have a quick look at the numbers. I am a math teacher, after all. That's 300 billion stars in our galaxy, 11 zeros. Next slide. 3,000 galaxies. A little bit of multiplication gets us up to 90 trillion stars. That's 13 zeros. And that's in the tiny bit of space that's covered by a marble at arm's length. Multiply that for all of the rest of the space in the visible universe, and you have a number which, according to Wikipedia, is called 1 septillion. It's 1 followed by 24 zeros. This number, unfortunately, is impossibly big to have any feeling for, but let's have a go anyway. Imagine, if you can, all the grains of sand on the beach at Allenby. Now add the grains of sand at Silloth. Then add the grains of sand on all the other beaches in the world. Then go to the Sahara Desert. Add all the grains of sand in the Sahara Desert and all the other deserts as well. Every single grain of sand anywhere on the surface of the Earth. Which leads us to an interesting question. Which do you think is bigger? The number of grains of sand on the Earth, the number of stars in the sky? It's not even a close competition. There are roughly 1 quintillion grains of sand on the Earth, just to keep you interested, which is 1 followed by 18 zeros. Next slide. Which means there are 1 million times more stars in the sky than there are grains of sand on the land. Or there are about 1 million stars for every single grain of sand on the face of the Earth. When God made the universe, he didn't hold back. Or as David puts it, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Moving on. According to the Bible, the stars weren't the first thing God created. Quick rhetorical question for you. What was the first thing God created? And God said, let there be light, was the right answer. I'm sure you all got it. Nearly 1,000 years ago, in 1054, Japanese and Chinese astronomers noticed a very bright light suddenly appear in the heavens. What you're looking at now is what they saw. This is the Crab Nebula. It is the leftovers from a star that the Japanese and Chinese saw explode 1,000 years ago. Now, let's think a little bit about light. It's the first thing God said he created, and it is quite extraordinary. It helps us see things. It helps us understand what things are. It helps us understand where things are. We experience that when all the lights go out and it's suddenly pitch black. A little light helps us to see and understand the world around us. An absolutely tiny amount of light is all we need to understand things which are far out of reach on the other side of the universe. A tiny bit of light arrives from a star far, far away. Because God made light in such an interesting and clever way, when that bit of light turns up at some sort of observatory, we're able to catch it and have a little look at it. When we look at the light, we're able to tell how bright the star is we're looking at. We're able to tell how big it is. We're able to tell what it's made of. Depending on what's inside the star, the light will look different when it arrives here. We're able to tell what atmosphere, if there is any, is around the star, or possibly around any planets that are floating near the star, because when the light travels through atmosphere, it changes again, leaving a telltale trace. We're able to tell how far away it is. We're able to tell how fast it is moving, and much, much more. To understand the universe we live in, we look at the light that manages to find its way to Earth. When Jesus called himself the light of the world, he was using a very good analogy. There is one other thing that light lets us do, which is very surprising. Light travels very fast. You can't see on the bottom of that slide. You can see the top of some words. What it says is that light travels at a speed of 186,000 miles in every second, which is quite quick, really. That means it takes light about 8.5 minutes to get from us to our nearest star, the Sun. It takes 4 and a bit years to get to the next nearest star, Alpha Centauri. But because light takes time to reach us, all of that information that we were talking about, which is neatly stored inside light, also takes time to reach us. If somebody stole the Sun, we would be blissfully unaware for 8.5 minutes. And then it would suddenly disappear. When the Crab Nebula exploded, it took the light 4,500 years to reach us. Which means when folk in the Far East were looking at it, they were actually travelling back in time and looking at something which happened 4,500 years ago. Light allows all of us to be time travellers. When God made light, he made something quite extraordinary. It is so helpful in letting us see and understand the world we live in, both close by and far away. It lets us travel in time, and much, much, much more could be said about light that we have no time to look at, and I do not understand. Next slide. That is not the Sun. That is the planet. Any astronomers out there? No, it's not. That is the planet Venus. I like the sound of your planet, though. It is a planet like Earth. It's one of our nearest neighbours. It is actually my favourite planet, and that is because it is the only planet in our solar system with a certain rather nice property. We'll keep these questions rhetorical. I think it works better. What is a day? How long is a day? How do we decide how long a day is? An illustration coming up for me. Have you got your sort of star-shaped balloon? Or have you popped it? Ooh. You didn't manage to burst it, but I'm sure I will. I can tell that. That is the Sun. I will now illustrate a day for you. At the moment, it is midday, and I'm enjoying the light from the Sun. The Sun is starting to go down. It's about sunset now. Dark, nighttime, can't see a thing, turn on the lights. Sunrise, ta! Now it is daytime again. A day is how long it takes the Earth to spin once on its axis. That's a day. How long is a year? This is a year. A year is how long it takes the Earth to take a stroll from one side of the Sun and get all the way back to the other side again. That is a year. Then it is better than school, isn't it? So what, I hear you say? Actually, I think I do. Next slide. On Venus, a year lasts for 224 Earth days. But a Venusian day lasts for 243 Earth days. On Venus, a day is longer than a year. It is the only planet for which that is true. And that's what makes it cool, in my opinion. Little people who live on Venus, if something took a long time, they say, it took years. If it took a really long time, they say, man, alive, it took days. There is another consequence of this, if you're interested in birthdays. On Venus, it tends to be the 1st of January, most days. One good consequence of that is if it's your birthday today, you can just about guarantee that it'll be your birthday tomorrow. In fact, it'll carry on being your birthday for about the next 19 years. And then you hit a Venusian equivalent of a leap year. And once every 19 years, they have the 2nd of January. No birthday. But no worries, the next day you'll have one. And they'll carry on for another 19 days after that. Yes. Both days, yes. Now, that's not the really significant thing about Venus for this morning. It's just what I like most about it. Venus is a similar size to us, a similar distance from the Sun, and so it should have a similar temperature. How hot you are basically depends on how far you are away from the Sun. Venus does not have a similar temperature to us. On Venus, things got a little bit out of hand. The surface has a temperature of 465 degrees centigrade, which is much, much, much too hot for a bath. It's much too hot for life, full stop, to be able to exist at all. What about other planets? Could life exist on them? From a Christian point of view, the Bible says nothing which suggests God made life elsewhere in the universe. But the bottom line, it is God's call. If he wanted to, he could have done. No evidence at the moment. Non-Christians are interested in the question because life is so cool. And they'd quite like to find some more of it, if it's out there. The first step in finding life is finding a planet where it's even possible that life could exist. Next slide. That's a photo. The only planet that we know of where life does exist. It's taken from the International Space Station. It is the nightlights of cities on the east coast of the United States of America. The Earth is really, really well put together. It is a perfect environment for life of many sorts to exist. I've just been reading a book by a man called David Walton called Lucky Planet. David Walton is a geologist, and really the whole book, he's not a Christian, by the way. The whole book is just explaining how extraordinary the Earth is. Next slide. There is a principle which is known as the Goldilocks principle. When something is just right, not too hot, not too cold, spot on. In his book, David Walton explains that the degree to which the Earth is just right for life is extraordinary. He is particularly surprised by how it has managed to stay just the right temperature. Not that it is the right temperature now. His surprise is how it's managed to stay the right temperature for about 4.5 billion years. And he explains all sorts of reasons why that's really, really surprising, and how if it wasn't the case, life couldn't exist here. He is so surprised by this that he ends up by saying, imagine all of those septillion stars in the visible universe, 1 million for each grain of sand on the Earth. Suppose that each star has about 8 or 9 planets, like our star does. He then says, it is so hard to make a planet where life can exist that ours may well be the only one, out of all of that completely ridiculous number of planets where life actually can exist. Extraordinary statement to make. The only sad thing about the book is its title. Just at the point where he should be saying, "Isn't God extraordinary?" All he says is, "Aren't we lucky? Aren't we lucky?" In summary, God has made an awesome universe, using the word awesome in its truest sense. The universe is very big, and there is a lot of stuff in it. When God made light, it was a really cool idea. It was very good. When God made the earth for us to live on, he seems to have gone to a great deal of effort. Amen.
There's some worship now. I'm sure you'll want to respond.